The 19th Amendment, establishing the right of women to vote, was ratified 100 years ago. Now, a century later, we're looking into the many ways this pivotal moment in American history has, or has not, changed our society and its governance. Here with this month's chapter in our ongoing series is EKU Professor of History, Jackie Jay.
As we've seen throughout this series, the experiences of women fighting for the right to vote differed greatly depending on where they were in the country and what race they were. Back in March, I talked with Sarah Egge of Centre College about the situation in the Midwest, and we learned just how much of an issue the voting rights of immigrants from Germany became in states like South Dakota. In the past few months, my co-host Kathy Kern has explored the experiences of Black Americans with a number of her colleagues from the University of Kentucky. Today, I'm here with Dr. Melanie Goen to talk about the struggle as it developed here in Kentucky. Dr. Goen is associate professor in the University of Kentucky Department of History, and her book, A Simple Justice, Kentucky Women Fight for the Vote, will be published this fall. Congratulations and welcome to the series, Melanie.
Thanks, Jackie. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, so I'll start by asking you, what's distinctive about the situation in Kentucky? What made it different from the fight for women's suffrage elsewhere in the country?
Well, I'm guessing for a lot of folks, for me included, before I really dug into studying the situation in Kentucky, Kentucky's not the first place that comes to mind when we think about the fight for the vote. We might think about New York and Seneca Falls, or maybe Wyoming, where women got the right to vote first, or Tennessee, where the battle ended, but usually not Kentucky. So Kentucky it presents its own set of circumstances. And what we see is in the South, suffrage took off more slowly than it did in other parts of the country. And I mentioned the West. A lot of the early victories in the Western states, a lot of the organizing went on in the Northeast. And the South had really lagged behind, presenting barriers for woman suffrage to take hold. And probably people can reason out why that was so. If you know anything about the South, you might understand that patriarchy was really entrenched in that area. Women tended to be held up on a pedestal, and it seemed the natural order of things for men to make decisions for women. Also in the South, you had strong biblical faith, a Christian faith that caused people to look at the injunctions, for instance, from the Apostle Paul that women were to keep silent. And so Southerners had a natural aversion, it seemed, to considering expanding the roles of women. And in the South, most importantly, enfranchising women threatened the racial order. The 15th Amendment, following on the heels of the Civil War, had enfranchised African-American men, but Southerners really resented this. They viewed this as a supreme indignity. It was federal intrusion. In white Southerners' minds, to consider woman suffrage was to endorse the 15th Amendment and to threaten all that held dear. It would reopen some of these big questions. And they also tended to see suffrage as a Yankee invention, something that the Northerners were trying to force on them. Many argued that the women of their region were perfectly happy the way things were. And we saw last time, back in March, you talked with Sarah Egge, and she talked about the circumstances that influenced suffrage's expansion in the Midwest. Here in the South, we see a similar set of unique challenges when it came to this question of expanding the franchise. But for national leaders, suffrage leaders who looked at ensuring the success of this movement, they knew they needed to expand it to all regions of the country. And so they had to get the South on board. And that's why a border state like Kentucky proved to be so important. Leaders believed that you had to have states like Kentucky kind of open the door for other southern states to follow.
And many of our listeners will know of key Kentucky figures like Laura Clay and Madeline Breckinridge. And so how do they develop against that backdrop that you've described? How do they come to be in a state like Kentucky?
Well, Kentucky came to national leaders' attention for several reasons. And part of it was the leadership that the state produced. You mentioned Laura Clay and Madeline McDowell, Breckinridge. But Kentucky, in other ways, too, was on national leaders' radar screens. For one thing, it was Southern, but it wasn't too Southern. It had never seceded during the Civil War. It had a smaller black population, which meant that some of these concerns of race and how that influenced the expansion of suffrage, that was less pronounced in a place like Kentucky. Kentucky also was held up as kind of a beacon of enlightenment in certain ways, as one of the first places in the country to enfranchise women. And very few people know this, but Kentucky women, some, very few Kentucky women, were voting as early as 1838. And they were doing so in just certain elections, school elections, and that might make some sense. As guardians of the home, guardians of the children, the state, when it created its common school system, enfranchised women who were widows, who were known as femme soul, who were single women, and who paid taxes, they could vote in school elections. And so national leaders, when they looked for inroads to the South, Kentucky seemed to be a place that had potential for opening those doors. One leader called it one single point of light. That's what Kentucky seemed to offer. And so these national leaders, they looked for how to begin that process of bringing the South on board. And you had some individuals within the state that stepped forward to open these doors. And the Clay family there, incredibly important in Kentucky in terms of woman suffrage, but also on a national basis as well. And you mentioned Laura Clay. Actually, it wasn't Laura Clay that first opened these doors. It was her older sister, Mary Barr Clay. And in the mid-1870s, Mary Barr Clay started showing interest in this national movement, a movement that most Kentuckians, if they were aware of it, they tended to shun, again, as a Yankee imposition. But Mary Barr Clay, she starts reading about suffrage. She writes into a national suffrage journal to announce that she was enlisted for the war. And she attended national conventions, invited Susan B. Anthony to visit Kentucky in 1879. And she starts this process, bringing her mother and her sisters on board.
Mm-hmm. I know that suffragists in Kentucky didn't always agree. So what were the major points of conflict? How did that division affect the struggle?
Yes, certainly there are many points of disagreement. And we like to think that certainly these women who are fighting for noble causes were probably all on the same page. We often think about suffrage as just the way history unfolds, a natural progression of events, but it was fiercely fought, and the women who fought those battles often disagreed on strategy. Laura Clay, Mary Barr Clay's younger sister, she was the one who established the Kentucky Equal Rights Association. She leads the movement for three decades. She makes it into a career. And in spite of her progressive desire to see women vote, she's pretty conservative in a lot of other ways. And she really stamps her ideas and her impression on the Kentucky Equal Rights Association.
As a conservative voice, what was that perspective?
Well, Laura Clay wanted to recruit among women that looked a lot like herself and upheld very similar values. She was very much a deeply religious woman, a Christian woman. And so, for instance, CARA, when it holds its annual meetings, they begin each convention with prayer, Bible readings sprinkled throughout the convention. That becomes problematic as the movement grows and as more women are brought into it, Jewish women, for instance. And later leaders, Madeleine McDowell Breckinridge, who becomes president, she's Laura Clay's hand-chosen successor in 1912, she dialed back some of that overt Christianity that Laura Clay had insisted upon.
Madeleine Breckinridge, she was wanting to open up enfranchisement more to other groups beyond just that white Christian narrow sector of society?
Yes, although Madeleine McDowell Breckinridge was a realist, and she recognized that many Kentuckians, white Kentuckians, shared the same priorities as Laura Clay. And so race will be a defining factor in Kentucky's suffrage movement. Even though Kentucky appeared racially progressive to many national leaders, when it came down to it, white Kentuckians tended to still believe that only whites should vote, and that expanding the franchise would open the door for African-American women to vote, and that was a dangerous force in their minds.
How did Kentucky get to the point of voting and ratifying on the 19th Amendment?
Women who wanted the vote didn't necessarily agree on the strategies to gain it. We like to think that history is this steady march of progress and that woman suffrage was bound to come just one more step toward achieving our high American ideals. But it was really a very contentious, messy process. In Kentucky, first of all, we should note that many women didn't want any part of voting, that there was strong anti-suffrage sentiment, especially in Western Kentucky. But even suffragists who could agree on the main goal couldn't always agree on how to achieve it.
So then for the last question in our last few minutes, I'd like to open it up to the bigger picture. Why do you think Kentucky's story matters? Why do you think it should be better known, both by us here in Kentucky and across the country?
Well, Kentucky as a border state was desirable for national leaders. They looked at this as their way to gain support in the South. But what it meant for the larger movement was bartering away its ideals and backtracking on universal equality. And Kentucky, as a place where race was central to the movement, both in its possibilities, what it seemed like the potential to win a southern state where race might not be as detrimental to the cause. But in reality, race was highly relevant here in this state. And the complexities of race in a border state really offer us an opportunity to better understand how race and gender worked together to inhibit women's right to vote.
Thank you. And that, I think, is a remarkable place to end, that once again, race is so central and the story in Kentucky has so many lessons that continue to resonate, especially given the situation we're in 2020. Thank you very much, Melanie.